Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Well, 2 weeks ago, the Christian woman Asia Bibi, who had been on death row in Pakistan for the last 8 years, was acquitted following a ruling by the Supreme Court of Pakistan. But what has been followed has definitely been anything but a fairy tale ending for her. Large demonstrations have been held in Pakistan protesting against the ruling and calling for the mother of five's public execution. And Imran Khan's government has moved to appease the protesters by banning her from leaving the country. So indeed, there are growing concerns for her safety. On the line to give us an update on her situation, we have John Pontifex, who's head of press and information at Aid to the Church in Need. Good morning, John. How are you?
Good morning, Wendy. Yes, I'm very well. I hope you are too.
Well, first of all, John, in terms of the whereabouts of Asia Bibi and just an update on her situation, do we know much? Because since her acquittal, there's kind of been a blackout of information on what's going to happen next.
Yes, the situation has been marked by information and counter-information, rumour and counter-rumour. But because we at Aid to the Church in Need are in close contact with the family of Asia Bibi, namely her husband Ashik and her daughter Isham and their helper Joseph, we've been able to take apart the facts from the case and from the fiction. And so we're able to say that she, Asia Bibi, is in Islamabad, where she is being held in a special secure place. The actual identity of this place is not absolutely clear, but it is a heavily security provided. And she is there. And one of the first things that she wanted to do when she arrived there, actually, was to be able to cook for her family. Well, of course, that's not quite been possible because her family members have not been able to join her there in Islamabad. And they are still very much in the Lahore area.
And presumably they are also in hiding and they are worried for their safety, John.
Yes, they are. And indeed, in the early days, which you described post the acquittal announcement, the mob was on the rampage and were looking for the family. And they were telling me that in those early days, they were told of how the mullahs were going from house to house, holding up phones with pictures of the family members, asking people, have you seen these people? And they told the story of how they were wanting to move around, and they felt the need to remove the rosary from their rearview mirror. And this was a sign of how they felt that their Christian identity put them at direct risk of attack. And meantime, they've been living day by day, waiting, hoping for Asia Bibi to indeed be released from this particular place where she's being kept for apparently for her own safety, and granted asylum somewhere in the West.
In terms of just the Pakistani government then, John, do you think that they have done enough to basically ensure Asia's safety? I mean, talking about her family there, it's obvious there hasn't been much done there to ensure their safety.
Well, it came as a huge disappointment when 4 days after the acquittal announcement by the Supreme Court, that we heard news, we woke to news, that the government of Imran Khan had in fact brokered an agreement with the Tehreek-e-Labbaik political party, an extremist group, which insisted upon Asia Bibi not being released. And they were the ones who insisted that the proceedings be started, whereby she'd be put on the exit control list and thereby be prevented from leaving the country, and also that the government would not in any way prevent a review of the Supreme Court's acquittal decision. Now, we've not really had an update on either of those two points, but they still act as a cloud hanging over the situation. And they explain, but I'm sure they explain at least in part, why any proceedings to get in place an asylum package for them have not actually come to fruition yet.
So in terms of what's going to happen for her next, John, because originally, and when we spoke about this before, and you've obviously mentioned asylum there, it was thought that she would be, as you said, taken out of Pakistan straight away. That has not happened. Is that possibility now gone, and could she be charged again?
Well, the family remain very hopeful. Now, at times we wonder whether this is sort of wish fulfillment on their part, or whether in fact they know more that enables them to remain competent. But as time goes on, we can begin to see that there are reasons for hope. The first reason is that the Supreme Court issued the documents relating to the judgment that they reached. And out of that, that documentation emerges very, very clear grounds for her acquittal. And those grounds are largely associated with the degree to which the evidence, the supposed evidence to support the claim of blasphemy, is actually very contradictory and very piecemeal, very patchy. And on the basis that it was conflicting, on the basis that it was patchy, the court really felt it had no option but to presume that she is in fact innocent and to give her the benefit of the doubt. And the truth of the matter is that it follows from that that clearly any review can only take place if there are sufficient grounds to suggest that this is a borderline case. Now, the court's decision indicates, for example, that the basis of the confession that Asya Bibi is meant to have given in front of a large group of people, the various witnesses have given very conflicting details about when this happened, where this happened, and of course the fact that she was beaten up, as was indeed her daughter Isham, and that her face was blackened, suggests that this was that she was coerced into making a statement, and that therefore her evidence was not neutral. It came in against a backdrop of pressure against her and threats, direct threats to her life. So the overriding drift of this is to suggest that if justice is allowed to prevail, then indeed Asya Bibi will be allowed to make a new future for herself and her family. But the problem we have in Pakistan is that the rule of law is at various times subjected to the mob rule, that in actual fact you have these large numbers of very well connected people who clearly want to bring the course of justice to a halt and prevent Asya Bibi from being released. And so, in a sense, we're in a situation at the moment where there's a tug of war between the rule of law and mob rule. And it's going to be extremely interesting.
It's a scary tug of war.
How it works out.
It's a scary one to think of, John, but adding pressure in that tug of war, to use that imagery. Can international pressure, do you think, be put on the Pakistani government to allow Asya to leave the country?
Well, the great point here is, of course, to do with international aid. Now, in the UK, and there are other countries too, there has been a commitment to providing overseas aid to Pakistan on the pretext that this is the surest guarantee to prevent the spread of extremism. Now, recently, the US government announced that it was going to withdraw its overseas aid to Pakistan, which means that countries like the UK have much greater leverage because of the threat of the withdrawal of that overseas aid. And this means that the government of Imran Khan can't ignore us. They can't ignore the West. They need the West. He's already had to apply to the IMF for support, and he's indicated that the country is in financial difficulty. So the international pressure is significant. The question is the actual nuanced direct nature of it, that if we start making critical remarks about the blasphemy law, if we make critical remarks about the mob and so on, that will not help. What's needed is to applaud the Supreme Court and to indicate that Pakistan, as a country of justice and liberty, it follows from that the government should be in a position to allow Asya to be set free.
Finally, John, just ask you an element that certainly isn't covered in the reporting of Asya's case is just the spiritual side to this, just in terms of her courage in her faith.
Yeah, I think this is a really important question to ask because it's so, as you say, so overlooked. What we, when the family, her husband Ashik and the daughter Isham came over to the UK as guests of aid to the Church in Need, they came over with a message from Asya. They'd seen her in jail in Mutan 2 days before they flew to the UK. And they said, we have this message from her. And I thought that it would be something like, I'm fed up with this prison, please get me out of here. But instead she said, I am a Christian, I remain a Christian, and I will die a Christian. And I will not brook any attempt to dissuade me from the faith that I profess. And I think it's right to say that her faith, her courage, her determination has been an inspiration that has driven this whole campaign to see to the day that she will one day be released. And we need to, all of us, salute her courage, her faith. And it's an example to all of us when we go through times of difficulty that there is this woman who has gone through even worse than most of us, and yet she has remained strong in her faith and does so at direct risk to her life and her freedom. We all know that if she were to renounce her faith at any point in these past 9 years, they would have been able to expedite the process and somehow the situation would have been resolved. But she refused. She was determined and has remained determined in her faith, and all of us have been deeply impressed by that. And her first words on coming out of that prison were to thank the Lord for delivering her, for answering the prayer in just the way that she was confident he always would. So that's something that really deserves highlighting.
John, thank you so much for that update today, and very well said by John, just the incredible inspiration that Asya Bibi is to our Christian faith. And when we reflect upon that, that she could have gotten 8 years of her life back if she would just renounce her faith. Yet she believes in Jesus Christ so strongly that she has been in prison for 8 years. And that in a very powerful way, I think, is very encouraging to us and in our belief and in our faith. That was John Pontifex talking to me, and he's involved with Aid to the Church in Need. If you want to get an update from them, you can go to acnuk.org. Also, to let you know, here in Ireland, a protest and indeed a prayer vigil in support of Asya Bibi and her family will be held at the Embassy of Pakistan, which is in Dublin today. That's Wednesday the 14th of November at 1 o'clock, organised by Irish charity Church and Chain. Well, we don't call our lovely country the Emerald Isle for nothing, because it always strikes me, especially when you've ever flown into any of our airports, and as you are coming, descending, you can just see beautiful green fields across the country and the wonderful farmland that we have. Well, our next guest hails from County Sligo, and he set himself a very interesting and unique challenge, and that was to plough a field in every county. So why did he decide to do it, and what has the impact been so far? On the line to tell us how his project has been going, we have Colman Colgan on the line. Good morning to you, Colman. How are you?
Good morning, Linda. How are you?
So, Colman, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a Sligo man?
I'm a Sligo man. I was born and reared in Sligo. But my father worked horses for ploughing and doing all the work up till the early 70s. And I would have been only a young chap then, but I would have helped him to lead horses. Now, I would never have ploughed, but then the tractors were got, and all the work was done with the tractors. But it was always along, and I had to have a team of horses. I thought there was something lovely about a big team of horses pulling a plough or doing any work, because the horse will do everything you want him to do to please you. All you have to do is talk to him.
And look after him.
Look after him. Well, my father always said that if the guy that would train, that would work the horse, would be the guy to feed the horse, because the horse would know who was looking after him well, and he'd always want to please you when you're working him. So 4 years ago, I set out and I bought a foal and a year and a half old Shire, they're Shire drafts. They're big horses now. They're one of the biggest, I'd say, in the world. One horse now is 18-2, and the other guy is 17-4 or 17-3. He'll make 18 hands, and the other guy will make 19 hands.
So, Colin, we'll have to break the... I'm a horsey person, so I know that that's pretty much as big as they get, 18 hands. These are big, strong horses. How much would they weigh?
They would weigh a ton. Okay. They would weigh 1,000 kgs.
Wow. And when it comes to horse-drawn ploughing, and there was a lovely picture of you with your two shires in the Irish Times, it's very rare that you see horse-drawn ploughing today. Was that one of the reasons you wanted to do it, because we don't see it anymore?
Well, I suppose it was. I thought it would be great if I had to sort of learn the trade. I wouldn't have been great at the start, but I have improved. Like, at the start, I was only, say, you're marked on 190 points in a ploughing match. That's the highest. That's about 170, 180 would be the highest any ploughman would get. But I have come from, say, 80 to about 160 I'd be getting now at the moment, and I'd be very happy at that. But I'm able to work the horses all on my own. I don't need a leader or anything. The horses will work for me, and I can work and plough at the drive the horses and plough at the same time.
So obviously this is something that you really enjoy, but what was the kind of impetus that gave you the idea to say, I'm going to try and plough a field in every county? Why did you want to do it?
Well, I suppose I might never win in All-Ireland, but I wouldn't think anyone ever set out to do that before. This ploughing match is held now. There could be 3 or 4, maybe some counties there could be up to 10 or 12 ploughing matches held in the one county. The likes of Cork now could have 12 ploughing matches. But nearly all, even the small counties here in the west, have only the one, but the bigger counties where a lot of ploughing would be doing, they'd have so many. So there'd be so many fellas picked from that. The winners of that county would be brought on to All-Ireland. But I suppose I was never going to get to an All-Ireland on a tractor. But I knew if I got a team of horses and get into it, I would get to All-Ireland. So I have been ploughed in All-Ireland for the last 3 years, but I thought it would be great. I made up the trailer to carry them on a lorry, because they're very heavy and you wouldn't carry them with a jeep. So I'm able to stable them on the trailer. So I thought it would be great to plough in every county. So I have a good lot. I have 26 counties nearly covered. I'm ploughing in Cork next Sunday now, and after that I have only one county left. So and I have 3 done in the north. But it's a bit of a challenge, because the ploughing has to go with the weather, you know. So that's where I'm coming from now. I would like to have to say that I was in every county anyway.
And you know, tell us a little bit about your experience so far. Obviously, you've achieved a lot. Have you had a favourite county to plough in? What sort of an impact has it had on you personally, Coleman?
Well, I've got a great welcome into every county. A great welcome, and like the guys that organise these ploughing matches, like, are great fellas in their own counties, and they give me expenses. A lot of them give me the expenses to get there and all, and I've got great welcome, fed and watered and looked after the very best, and the horses as well. Everywhere I went, I was well looked after, very best.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit more about your horses.
Ned and Ted is their names. Ned is a 5-year-old now, and Ted is 4-year-old. So they're not fully grown till they're about 7-year-old. They say they're still grown till they're 7 years. But they have great temperaments. They can take to everyone. Now you have to stand a while in front of them. They have to see you and look at you before they take up to you. But as soon as they take to you, as soon as you rub them at all, they're your friend. Like, they're lovely, pleasant horses. In England, they call them the gentle giants. And that's what they definitely are, gentle giants. They're very pleasant and very nice to work with.
In terms of just the project so far, and I know you said weather's a big thing, and you've got a lovely welcome in the different counties, but did you hope, Coleman, that one of the consequences would be that you might almost, especially for young people, revive an interest in ploughing with horses?
Well, I tell you now, what I would love to set up is to set up a farm. Now, I have only a small farm myself, but I'd love to set up for people to see what the horse was able to do. Definitely here in the west of Ireland, the horse should have been kept longer, because the land was heavy and wet, and the horse was able to plough in on wet land. And if you get 2 days, you can sow, where the tractor was too heavy and it packed the land. So, like, a lot of the farming that's doing here in the west, say in 50-acre holdings, a horse would have been ideal to keep, and he'd have been fed off the land. The farmer would have had more money if he had held on to the horse. The tractor looked good and was easy, but it didn't do all the work. As soon as the horse left the west of Ireland, the tillage left. They weren't able to till the land with the tractors. So the tillage is all gone and out of the west of Ireland, all on the head of the tractor coming. But I would love, if I was to live my life over again now, I would have held on to two horses and worked them on the land. And I'd say you'd have a happier life. It's lovely to work with horses, no noise, no nothing. And you get a relationship with them and you're talking to them. And they'll do everything you want them to do. And they're listening to you all the time.
And Colman, when just kind of chatting about that a bit further, you know, just the idea of bringing it back to basics, being out there on the land in nature with these beautiful animals, and you know, you're away from the hustle and bustle, the distractions. Have you found that kind of had a positive impact just on your outlook, on your mental health, and all those sorts of things?
Very much, very relaxing. Like if you take the horse and you're walking away there, you're talking to him, and you forget the time. And you're not listening. There's no noise to annoy you. Your head is in good shape when you're working with the horse, definitely. And horse is a lovely animal. I think a horse and a dog, the dog will always want to be your friend, and the horse is the same. I think they're the two loveliest animals on dirt.
Well, Colman, thank you so much for just chatting to us this morning, and we're behind you in terms of finishing your challenge. I know it's Cork in the spring is the next one, right?
Cork next Sunday and County Monaghan. I think I'll be finishing up in County Monaghan on the 3rd of February. But I have three counties left in the north of Ireland that I hope to cover as well.
Fantastic stuff, Colman. Thank you so much for chatting to us this morning on Spirit Radio.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you.
That was Colman Colgan there just telling us about his experience of trying to plough a field in every county. And just it's amazing to see, if you can picture, as Colman described there, these huge horses, 18 hands high, they weigh about a ton each. He is tiny in comparison to these beautiful and majestic animals, and just ploughing with them and bringing it back to how things used to be done. Really, really interesting stuff. Our Prayer Coach series is continuing today, and today we're talking to, I'm delighted to have him back in studio, Reverend Gary McDowell, who's minister at Greystones Presbyterian in Greystones in County Wicklow. And today we're talking about identity. What is identity? Where do we get our value from? And, you know, in many ways you could argue, especially for young people when there's so much pressure on them to appear to be a certain way or live up to certain standards, there's a bit of an identity crisis going on, and probably all of us at some point in our lives experience that kind of identity crisis where we're trying to figure out who we are and why we're here. And sometimes I think that we sadly try to measure our value in all the wrong places. So that's what we're going to be talking about today with Gary. So good morning to you.
Good morning. Who am I?
Who are you?
Who are you?
You tell me.
Why am I?
Well, okay, let's start with that. If you say who are you, I think a lot of the time, Gary, a Christian would say, you know, I am a person made in the image and likeness of God. Okay, what does that mean? Oh, I don't really know how to explain it.
It would take a long, long, long time. That's a very deep thing, isn't it? But I think the essence of it is that we are special. There's nothing else in all creation that has that kind of tag. He made birds and animals. So we're not simply at the end of an evolutionary line. We are unique. Made in his image is... you can tease out in a million different ways, but we're like him in so many ways. We're there to... rule and to care and to love. So all those kind of qualities, all those kind of facets of God, which are many, 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 but everybody listening to this is made in that image. They are precious because they are.
Well, I think we find that hard to accept.
I know, so do I. That's why we need to keep telling ourselves, because the world will tell us all sorts of things. I was saying to you about how identity theft is such a big thing these days. You've got to be careful. Nobody sees that PIN number as you're putting it in, or steal your credit card or your passport, and do all sorts of bad things pretending to be you. But the world tries to steal our identity. Our culture tries to tell us you should be like this or you should be like that. Or voices inside our heads say, oh, I'm rubbish at this. I'll never amount to anything, because that's what I was told when I was a child. So try to rob us of our identity. And we need to not listen to those voices, but to listen to the voice of truth, which is the voice that you talked about, where God says, you are special, you are precious because you're made in my image. Not because of what you've done or what you're doing or because you're great or you failed to do, but you simply are. That's a basic truth. This is who you are.
How do you remind yourself of that every day?
Well, I've got this passage from 1 Peter that I was going to use. But reading the Bible, which tells us that we are precious, you know, value is measured in many things. But one of the ways we value things, like if I wanted to sell my house, what is my house worth? It's worth what someone's prepared to pay for it. To me, it might be worth millions, but someone else might be worth not so much. But it's only worth what someone's prepared to pay for it. And as I read the Bible and I see what God has done and how he sent the Son, and we're thinking about that at Christmas time when he sent on that first Christmas, but he sent Jesus. Ultimately, Jesus died on a cross, paid a great price for everybody listening to this broadcast today. You are valuable because Jesus was worth, or thought you were worth paying the ultimate price for. So as we read the Bible, that says that over and over and over again. It keeps trying to tell us that we are actually special, to know our identity in him, to build us up. God's always wanting to build us up, never to knock us down. When he looks at us, like you're looking at me with those lovely eyes, Wendy, it is always with eyes of compassion and love, never condemning eyes.
It's interesting that you're talking about eyes, right? Because I was reflecting on this the other day, and just as we're chatting about identity and how God values us, sadly, isn't often how we value ourselves. And if we could only see ourselves the way God sees us, see ourselves through God's eyes. And I was trying to think of what's the best kind of comparison I can think of. And I thought, you know, it's probably greater, but a similar understanding as how a parent sees their child. You know, how I see my son and any daughters that hopefully will come in the future, that when they may see themselves in a negative way, a parent always sees the best and the beautiful. But I think, again, we find it hard to get into that mindset of, you know, God loves us flaws and all.
That's right. Yeah, we kind of live in a culture where it's that kind of performance related. You know, if you do well, you'll be rewarded. And we get that even from childhood. If you're good, you get some sweeties at the end of the week, or, you know, you have a star chart. And
we reward very kind of worldly things, for want of a better word, where we seem to kind of look up to people who achieve a lot in terms of making money or having lots of possessions, even though the evidence is so clear in terms of that doesn't actually bring happiness, and in fact brings misery a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But yet that our human condition drives us to seek our identity in those things that can change so quickly.
That's right, and they can. And yet it's completely illusionary, and yet we buy into that kind of false narrative, that dream, because that's what the world tells us. I was listening to someone who was saying that, you know, what we should be doing is valuing people and using things. But so often we value things and we use people. But that's not the way God sees us. God is, over and over again, he is the perfect father. In fact, it's got imagery of a mother in there, like where Jesus said so many times, I wanted to gather you under my wings like a hen gathers her chicks, but you wouldn't let me. He wants to embrace us. He wants to love us. He sees the best in us. And it's not about our achievement. It's not about what we do good or good bad. It is simply because he loves us, because he loves us, because he does. And so if anybody's listening to this and they feel my life's rubbish and I'm rubbish and it's going nowhere and, oh, everybody else is doing great things and my life is just hopeless. You know, you really don't need to feel like that because you are special. The Bible tells you so. If you believe it, feel it, God will, you know, do amazing things in your life. Change your outlook, because it's all in our head, isn't it? It's a little game you play in our head, and the world plays with our heads as well.
Do you think that's something that I suppose we need to remind ourselves of? And I think you can see that in a few different ways, Gary, in that I've been struck as I've travelled to many different countries all over the world, some of them very, very poor countries, with people who have very little, and meeting people and thinking, isn't it incredible when we see the world through our Christian faith that those people, or a person from a country very different to my own with a very different life experience, has the exact same value as me. And a lot of the problems that are caused in today's world are because people decide, sadly, that they are superior because they have money or because they have power. But God sees us all as equally valued.
That's right. It's like not having a favourite child. When you have about a dozen children, Wendy, you'll love each of them. They'll all be very different. Some of them will wind you up and some will give you great pleasure, but you will love them
and
equally.
Unconditionally.
Unconditionally, yeah.
What would be your advice, because you touched on it there, just for someone who is feeling that loss of identity, you know, and just wanting to be regrounded almost in their identity and knowing their value, as you said. What Sorry. Do you do? Big question. I guess it's like the voices in our head, you know, the negative voices. So, so people are listening to you, Gary, and they're saying, okay, this is great. I have infinite value in God's eyes. I'm special. He created me. Okay, but then there's these other really loud voices that are saying all these negative things, and or maybe I feel that for a time, and then boom, I go out into the world and I'm just hit by this wave of pressure and negativity. How do you rail against that?
Well, I suppose you just have to sit at the master's feet. You know, there's no shortcut. Just stop and think and listen. In 1 Peter chapter 2, if you can read this later on in verse 9, Peter's talking to people who are obviously in an identity crisis as well, because they're going through hard times, just like that lady in Pakistan. You know, her faith has been threatened. There's all sorts of pressures from within and without. But he just tells them, look, you're a chosen people. I think it's a lovely phrase. To be chosen is amazing. Chosen. You are a chosen people. Back in the day when armies used to raid villages or towns or cities or whatever, and they would just loot it, they would take all the best stuff back to their tent. And the commander of the army, it was his privilege to go round the tent of his men, and he could choose anything from their loot that he wanted. He could choose the best of the best. They had taken the best, the most valuable, but he could take what he valued most. And he could take all of this. And that's the image here. It's as though God has gone round the tent and chosen the most valuable. And that's what he says to people like you and me. You are precious. You are chosen because he chooses us. He created us. I think it's just a wonderful imagery. We're not special because what we've done, what we've achieved, but by who we are, and he places his value. And we can only do that as we sit down and read that and say, Lord, is that true for me? And as we pray around that, he will say to you, yeah, that is true. As we sit at his feet, we'll hear his still small voice who says, Wendy, you are precious to me, not because of how wonderful you are, and you are, but because you are mine, created in my image, and I have chosen you.
A lovely reflection to finish on today. I've been joined by Reverend Gary McDell, who has been our prayer coach today, and prayer coach continues every Wednesday just after the 11 o'clock news. Gary, as always, thank you for your wisdom on Spirit Radio this morning.
Anytime at all, Wendy.
It's a shocking statistic and something that has been reported on for quite some time, but things don't seem to be improving in great strides. 1 in 4 primary school children are overweight or obese in this country. That is a staggering fact. Ireland is set to be one of the fattest nations, according to the World Health Organization, by 2020. And obviously the consequences in terms of our health, and especially our children's health, if we don't get a handle on this, is going to be disastrous. So there's many things that need to be done, but is one of those, when we think of the different ads that are on TV, billboards, of course, very, very targeted ads, specifically targeting children on social media with fatty, sugary foods, with chocolate bars and crisps and sugary drinks that, you know, a lot of money goes into making these deliberately attractive and appealing to young people. Well, the Irish Heart Foundation have launched their Stop Targeting Kids campaign, and they're calling for strict restrictions around food ads aimed at children. And on the line, just to tell us a little bit more, we have Chris Macy, who is the head of advocacy for the Irish Heart Foundation. Chris, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
Well, just put a bit of context in terms of the issue of childhood obesity in Ireland. How bad is it?
It's very bad. You said 1 in 4 children there. It's actually gone up, according to the latest statistics. Now 30% of girls and 31% of boys are overweight,
so
or obese.
So 1 in 3,
So it's actually going up. I suppose Safe Food, which is a government-funded body, predicts that 85,000 of today's children living on the island will die prematurely due to overweight or obesity. Doctors we talk to are telling us of evidence of something quite catastrophic already happening. We now have children as young as 8 presenting with high blood pressure, and young people showing early signs of heart disease that were once only seen in middle age. So what's junk food marketing got to do with this? I suppose the causal link between junk food marketing to children and childhood obesity was really proved 15 years ago. And it's the reason why ads for unhealthy food and drinks were restricted on broadcast media, on TV and radio, 5 years ago. But there's still major loopholes in these regulations, and it means that children, according to UCD research, aged between 3 and 5 are still seeing more than 1,000 ads a year on television alone. And weak voluntary regulation of digital marketing has resulted in an explosion of that in the last few years, and that's much more personalized, effective, and therefore potentially even more damaging. So we know that once-off exposure to a single ad for unhealthy food or beverages will increase, this is UK research, increases food intake between 30 and 50 calories for a child. Now, it only takes an extra 48 to 71 calories to generate a day to generate weight gain in children over time. So, you know, if children were only seeing one ad, they're close to the threshold for adding weight. But we know they're seeing a lot more than that. UK research also shows that seeing one extra junk ad a week results in an average extra consumption of 18,000 calories a year.
Wow.
So we're talking about a big problem.
That part of the problem, Christoph? Because, I mean, that's certainly something that has shocked me in terms of that we don't realise the kind of compound effect of, oh, it's only a little chocolate bar or a small treat or whatever, but just that if that is in the diet and treats are a kind of daily part of the diet rather than what they're meant to be, a treat, the compound effect of that can be really,
It's the relentless bombardment of our children by these people who have no right to be talking to our children in the first place. And what happens is parents get the blame for it. Parents are blamed because of the pester power that these advertisers, and these are the cleverest advertisers in the world, don't make any mistake, because they're working for the richest companies in the world. They deliberately generate pester power by children on parents. And it is very, very hard, as anyone who's a parent will know, it's very hard to resist. We had a man at an event last week who used to be a senior advertising executive in the UK. Dan Parker's his name. He's doing some work with the Jamie Oliver Foundation now. He got diabetes, nearly died, and saw the light and is now campaigning for as we are for a ban on junk food marketing to children. He made the point that in the 70s, you know, everyone essentially had three meals a day, and that was it. You know, there was no snacking. But now children use the word snack and treat, interchangeably. So what advertisers and junk food junk food companies have done is to create a whole industry around snacking that was worth zero, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, and is now a 374 billion euro worldwide industry. They've largely created this problem. And, I mean, our simple message is, why on earth should they be allowed to bombard our children with adverts encouraging them to do something that isn't good?
So from a legislative perspective then, Chris, what are you proposing?
Well, I suppose there's two things. We want a complete ban on digital marketing to children under 16. You know, people have said to us, oh, you can't regulate the internet. Well, the Cambridge Analytica scandal showed us that we actually can. If you can target individuals based on their, you know, their age, their various demographics, you can untarget them as well. We know that children using the internet are not getting ads for cigarettes here because it's illegal, and we know that they're not generally getting ads for alcohol because as social media platforms can target individuals, they can untarget them as well. So we want a complete ban on that, and we want, as an initial step, we want the broadcast ban, which at the moment relates to programs up to 6 p.m. On television, that where the 50% of the audience are children. We want that to be increased to a 9 p.m. watershed. Again, UK's stats showed that only 27% of children's TV time is actually in that up to 6 p.m. Bracket, and most of it is in what the industry calls family viewing time, which is, you know, soap operas and X Factors and other sort of competitions like that. You know, that 6 to 9 p.m. Time is when most children are watching television. So we want junk food ads to be removed then. Cancer Research UK did a study that showed that, you know, there's up to 9 ads every half an hour for junk food in on television in those times.
And you could argue, Chris, a lot of the time that they can be misleading in some ways, not just for parents, but for children as well. I remember just very recently seeing a huge billboard. It was for chocolate, and it was basically the kind of key selling point was the amount of milk, whatever it says, a glass and a half of milk. So as a parent, you're looking at it going, oh, well, it can't be that bad if there's so much milk in it.
That's called health washing. And Dan Parker had a very interesting observation on that. When he was working in the industry, working for big unhealthy food brands, cereals specifically, there was a question that the marketers always ask, what's in it for mom? So if you have this big cereal box with the cartoon star on it, the child will say, I want that one, I want that one. Mom takes a look at it, you know, because it's generally, I think it's probably still generally mothers that do most of the family shopping. You know, mom takes a look at it, and if there's, you know, there has to be something like high in fiber. And once mom sees high in fiber on it, she says to herself, oh, well, that's not too bad then. At least it's reasonably healthy. There's obviously no mention that the cereal in question will be absolutely packed full of sugar and will not be good for the child. So it's that sort of health washing. They're absolutely masters at it in the junk food industry, and that's something we want to be ruled out. If a product is unhealthy, we want the box to say it's unhealthy, not to say it's healthy, as is happening across the board at the moment.
Is another part of this, Chris, just finally to ask you about, obviously awareness for parents is one thing, but also awareness for young people who, you know, they have money in their pocket. I'm thinking of walking to primary school, you know, myself, 10, 11, 12, and you'd stop in the little newsagent on the corner, and before it was even 9 o'clock, you'd be eating sugary gummy sweets and all that sort of stuff. Definitely nothing in my head about this could be actually bad for me. Do we have a long way to go just in terms of educating ourselves and our children?
We do, but, you know, Think back to when cigarette advertising was banned, and I'm not linking cigarettes to any type of food, but you know, could you imagine, we've reduced the number of smokers in this country by, I think it's about 250,000 in the last 10 years. Could you imagine that happening if the bombardment of cigarette ads was still going on, saying how, you know, how cool or how sexy it is to be a smoker? You know, of course it wouldn't. A prerequisite for changing the way people look at the food they buy and eat is to take this, you know, particularly children are more susceptible to advertising, is to take this, you know, bombardment away from them. That is, you know, it's encouraging and convincing them to do things that they, you know, that buy things that they wouldn't otherwise buy. So that's, you know, that's something that we can do. Of course, children like sweets. Of course, you know, in that transition from primary school to secondary school, a bit more freedom, a bit more money in your pocket. You know, you might be more likely to go to the shop before school and buy something that's not good for you. But, you know, part of changing behavior is removing this totally unnecessary bombardment of advertising directed at children by very, very clever people.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That was Chris Macy, who's head of advocacy for the Irish Heart Foundation, just talking about the need to ban the targeted junk food advertising, which is targeted at our children. If you want to support the campaign and you want to find out more, you can go to their website, which is irishheart.ie.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.